This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Back in February, NASA successfully landed the Perseverance rover on Mars. The pictures it transmitted back to Earth of the red planet were spectacular and captured the imagination of millions. It also gave the Cambridge Dictionary its first hint on what this year's Word of the Year would be. They got a huge bump of hits on their online entry for the word Perseverance. That, coupled with the ongoing pandemic, made Perseverance an obvious choice. To learn about the process and to find out how the dictionary business is going these days, I spoke to the publishing manager of the Cambridge Dictionary, Wendelin Nichols. I asked how long they've been cranking out a word of the year.
We started in 2015. So this is the seventh year. The American Dialect Society started that whole ball rolling. They were the ones to choose a word of the year, and they actually waited till the year was over. You know, they chose it. It's at their annual meeting between Christmas and New Year. And at some point, I think Oxford were the next ones to kind of say, hey, I think we'll do one. And so I felt that if we were going to do that, it had to actually be meaningful rather than, well, we're a dictionary publisher and we're going to kind of look at the zeitgeist and pick something. You know, we were online early in 1999. And so as a result of that, and a lot of work over the years, we're a global website. But the unique thing about us is that we're for learners of English, and we're really data driven. What we put into the dictionary is driven by what people are looking up and they can't find. And we have people actively adding, looking out for new words and new meanings and adding like 150, sometimes upwards of 200 a month to the site. So for us, what I felt was, okay, let's look at what people actually looked up and see if we find things that are anomalous. And can we tie that to what's going on in the world? So it's only been twice that we've actually chosen something that was a neologism. You know, 1 year was upcycle and another was nomophobia, right? All the rest of them have been to do with the zeitgeist spiking because of what was going on in the world. So we found that last year with quarantine. But for us with quarantine, what was interesting is there's a feedback loop between this word of the year process. And we go back and revisit our definitions for words. And last year, we found that there was a whole new meaning that emerged of quarantine that was the equivalent of lockdown. So we completely rewrote those entries. And this year, the Perseverance rover triggered people looking it up. But because our site is for learners of English, they don't know what Perseverance means. So we saw a huge spike, obviously, around about February 18th when the rover landed. But then the lookups have stayed higher over the course of the year with some extra bumps around the news.
So now that Perseverance has been named the word of the year, what else has Cambridge done to augment understanding of the word?
We have a thesaurus article about the difference between perseverance and persistence and being determined and stick-to-itiveness, you know, giving more information to learners than just here is the definition of perseverance. So when we look at perseverance, we want to say, well, how does the thesaurus treat that and the differentiation between those entries? And we do want to have time to actually look at the way that we've accounted for this word and say, well, maybe we need to be more precise here or there, because the dictionary that this sits in originated in 1995. And a word like perseverance probably was there from 1995 and might not have been revisited, except for major re-editions, maybe twice in its history. And so it's always worth going back and saying, well, can we be even more helpful for users? You know, when would you use persistent as opposed to, you know, perseverant, you know, which, and the perseverant is like this rare formal sort of, but we need to make sure that that's part of it. So there is a whole group of words if you look at the thesaurus entry. So we could tie that into what's happened in the world right now. And it just felt like, well, what a beautiful metaphor for what we have to do as a world and a society with the pandemic and everything going on is to persevere. So we tried to be very data driven from the start.
There's no way we would have made it out of 2020 without perseverance.
That's absolutely right. And the thing about perseverance that is different from just determination that we discovered, because we look at, we have 2.5 billion, I forget how many billions of words the corpus is now, but this massive data collection of written and spoken English that we analyze as, you know, lexicographers, we look at the environment in which words are being used and the other words that are used along with it. And that is how you start to tease out nuances of differences in meanings. So perseverance, it's a mental strength as opposed to a physical one for the most part. It is different from determination in that determination is almost always associated with a really concrete goal, whereas perseverance is, there may be no end in sight, but I'm going to keep going. And you're trying to achieve something, but you don't know if you'll ever get there, but you do it anyway. It gives you a chance to just go back and look at an old word in a new light.
How has the dictionary business changed in the digital age?
Oh, mercy. First of all, the biggest change for me over the course of my career, and I started in 92 after having been an English as a second language teacher for, you know, like 12 years. The move from print to digital has meant that the constraints of 1600 pages for, say, a college dictionary, and nobody wanted to print more than 1600 because you had to move to different equipment and they had to charge more. Nobody wanted to charge more than $25, you know? So you kept having to try to cram more and more stuff. If you wanted to add new words, something had to come out. So space impinged on lexicography. When you move into the digital space, it changes your considerations. All of a sudden, more is better because Google doesn't like it if your page is too thin. You know, you need to have rich content on a page, especially for those of us that rely on advertising. If you just have a little, you know, not very much information on a page and a lot of advertising, it will figure out that you're trying to game the system and it will de-index you, you know. So you have to start thinking about, well, what does it mean to provide rich information to people? And the temptation is to just pile in programmatic stuff and just make your page longer. And for us, that's not really helpful for learners because it can overwhelm them with information. So you have to start thinking about what would you have done if you could have done it when you had to be use all these abbreviations and contractions and this derivative forms and not really give full definitions and examples of them because you didn't have the space. We have taken all the ly and the ness endings on, you know, certain words and made them, given them their own entry. But it is also, so it's changed the lexicography itself and what you can cover. But it also has, with social media in particular, the people that used to campaign via fax machine. So you would come in on a Monday morning and the fax machine was beeping because it had run out of paper and you put more paper in it because people were, you know, really angry about some word or another, you know. It was a whole big media thing. Well, now that happens immediately by Twitter. Somebody gets angry and boom, it just explodes all over the place. And dictionary publishers don't have the chance to have a rounded conversation about why they are characterizing a given word in a particular way, because there's just too much, all that polarization that's in society that makes people not grant others the space so that they can listen. That happens in the dictionary world too. We get people campaigning to put their pet words in. And if they can just find a celebrity to tweet about it and try to, there's this sort of shame on you, Cambridge Dictionary, that you haven't put this kid's word in. You know, so, we did not have to deal with that when it was just print.
I did not realize dictionaries had Twitter trolls attacking them. That's news to
we
me.
We absolutely do, you know, and I get, here's a really interesting example, I think. And that is, you probably are aware of Corey Stamper's book, Word by Word, and she has a chapter on tackling the entry for the word bitch, right? Okay. It used to be lexicography was very strict about having equivalency style definitions, right? So you could just take the definition, stick it into the sentence where that word sat, and then it would work. You know, it would work grammatically and it would work in terms of its meaning to just be slotted in. And so the definition would be, it would have a label that would say disparaging or insulting or offensive or whatever that dictionary editorial policy was for signaling that this is not a nice word. but it would be up at the top of the entry and it would be in italic, and the definition itself would say a nasty and unpleasant woman or something like that. The kind of lens of the way that people look at language now, they look at that entry and they say, that is drawing an equal sign. This is who she is, you know? And so those kinds of definitions are problematic. And now we need to use usage style definitions that say, used to an insulting word for, you know, someone who you think is, you know, for a woman who is blah, 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 right? So we're having to, and I think that's a good thing, because I think that dictionary publishers had raised to a high art the the ability to make a virtue out of the necessity for brevity, right? And people bought into this. They would say, oh, well, if I don't understand a dictionary definition, there must be something wrong with me, rather than there must be something wrong with the dictionary that can't explain it without making me go look up seven words in the definition in order to understand the definition.
Is there the temptation now to maybe go a bit too long now that you're not constrained by size?
Yes. Yes. And there's a limit after which it just becomes too discursive and imprecise as a result. Oddly enough, longer doesn't necessarily mean more precise. You can repeat yourself. The temptation is to allow for too many outlying uses of the word within the core meaning. The question of whether to lump or split, which is the classic way of describing how a dictionary editorial policy approaches the lexicography to account for a word. Do you split it into a whole bunch of hairline meanings, or do you kind of lump them all? Do they all kind of fall into a family and you lump it together? And the answer to that has partly to do with, well, who's your audience? You know, so a learner dictionary, we tend to lump more because it's not helpful for the users to have that kind of nicety. But an unabridged dictionary for native speakers does tend to really tease out very subtle differences in meanings. Whether that's helpful or not, it's an open question.
So when do you all get together and start choosing next year's?
Okay, so our word of the year process now, we start looking at the data at the end of August, believe it or not. So it's really sort of the word of the last 8 months plus the previous four, because there's such long lead times in developing the campaign around it. So we pretty much settle on it by end of September. Look, our language research team does a deep dive into the corpus every year now. And we, for those who want to follow that trail a bit further, there's a deep dive into the data. What is the data telling us about the word perseverance? So we have to have time to do that. So yeah, we actually start alerting the data people to the fact that we need to be gathering the data right after Labor Day, I'd say. Mm-hmm. There's a particular software called Sketch Engine that we and other dictionary houses use to help us analyze that corpus data. And it helps create these kind of maps that tell you what other words co-occur a lot with perseverance, you know, the collocational behavior, what it modifies, what it's modified by, what it is, you know, perseverance and what its context really is. Yeah. And so then you, those words that are part of that thesaurus study are really evident from that kind of map. They jump out at you, you know, and that really helps you choose the right example sentences as well, because for our type of dictionary, we're not quoting published text and giving a citation, you know, the way that the Oxford English Dictionary does, or the fuller versions of Merriam-Webster's Unabridged. We look at that data as coming from a range of texts. You know, it could be, you know, published and edited and highly academic. It could be ephemera. It can be spoken stuff. It does everything in between. And our lexicographers need to look at those, and then they will shorten or modify the sentences so that they have pedagogical value for the users, so that they're not too long, so they don't have such high level words that you aren't focusing on what perseverance means. You're focusing on some other word in the sentence that's hard, and then pulling out the patterns and highlighting them. Because most, you know, native speaker dictionaries are not about production. They are about, can I understand what a word means? It's decoding a learner dictionary has to teach people how to use it. So it's a really big difference.
Wendolyn Nichols is the publishing manager of the Cambridge Dictionary. Still to come, when choosing a college, is the school's sustainability a factor in your choice? We'll talk about a guide to green colleges next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Sustainability is one of the many criteria that students and parents use when choosing a college. And the Princeton Review has got a guide for that. Their 12th annual Guide to Green Colleges was released last month and has listings for 420 schools in the U.S. and Canada, as well as a few in some far-off places around the globe. To find out how they put together this guide, we invited back Rob Franek, the editor-in-chief of the Princeton Review. I asked Rob how important sustainability is when it comes to choosing a college or university.
Well, absolutely. And we, and you and I have talked about this idea in the past, but you know, our full focus at Princeton Review is to help a student and their families and counselors, of course, find a school that's going to be a best fit for a student academically, campus culture, financial aid, career services. But when we ask students specifically about sustainability on campus, and then are those students going to get jobs of substance that are also going to be sustainable upon graduation, it factors in to their decision-making process on figuring out if that school is ultimately going to be one of the schools that they apply to. So it is a powerful, powerful metric for so many students.
So when you go about putting this list together, what do you look at? What's your criteria?
We look at a couple of different things, as you might imagine, and there are hundreds and hundreds of schools that we consider for inclusion into the list and into the guide. But we look at sustainability practices on campus, and that includes food service, transportation services on campus, green residence halls, and activities that are happening in and around the campus. Then we also look at sustainability that is practiced in the classroom. And that could be, academic disciplines that focus on sustainability. But the truth is, you know, that most of these schools are liberal arts schools, so they're true Renaissance schools. So that's kind of filters into lots of different academic subjects. And then our students getting green jobs, sustainable jobs upon graduation.
And you do list these schools alphabetically, so there's not this school is greener than the other one, right?
That's true. Yeah. So you know, the whole idea of just having a list of distinction and that is, I mean, there are just 420 schools, are chosen for this guide. So it is a wide and varied group of schools, but that's the way we want to keep it, you know, to keep the lens very wide for students to consider fit on many different factors, sustainability being one of them.
And of course, the overwhelming majority of these schools are in the U.S. You do have some schools in Canada. And then you go like to the other side of the world for a few. What brought Egypt into this equation?
Well, you know, we do have a powerful data engine at the Princeton Review. And you're very right. We look for the majority of the time looking at schools that are national. But we have long surveyed Canadian schools and other international schools as well. So we try to ensure that students will simply have different schools on their list. And we want that to be a global perspective.
All of these schools have a sustainability officer. What does that officer do?
Sustainability officers, and this is, it varies at different schools, but generally speaking, that sustainability officer will help with different things. One, integrating sustainability into curricula, so working with faculty members through the provost office and offices in that vein, and then focused on what students are doing by way of career services, on campus, helping them to move on to sustainable either internships or experiential learning or learning communities while they're undergraduates, and then moving on to jobs after they graduate. But the lion's share of their focus is going to be sustainability as it affects a student's life. That's both inside the classroom and, of course, outside the classroom, residence halls, dining facilities, as we said before, transportation services on campus. What is that school doing by way of fuel consumption on campus, and how are they incorporating sustainable practices in that daily life of a student and the school?
Do you take into account communities at all? Because I see there are some very rural schools, and you know, there's Brooklyn College too.
Of course, when we do try to keep that in mind, but again, we rely on two sources of information for our green guide, and that is both given by the school itself and then student opinion there as well. So in many ways, student opinion and the way a school interacts with the community could play into this fact, but we're relying on both of those sources. We don't have a separate survey that surveys the community of, you know, X community outside of their campus gates.
Well, how much of this is based on student feedback? I know you had to do a lot more this year because of the pandemic.
Absolutely. And this is so valuable to us. I mean, in thinking about student opinion, we ask students their experiences about how sustainability practices will influence their life and education. Is there community support through the administration? Other student environmental supports? Is there general awareness on campus? So those are many of the things that we will ask. And so it does factor in heavily into the way that we look at this algorithm and our general methodology.
So do these schools, you know, kind of lobby you, say, hey, look how green we've got. We want to be on this list.
Generally speaking, no, they don't lobby us. But you know, being that we've been putting this into play for 12 years, many schools are aware of it. And we have so much participation, both from, again, administrators on campus, as well as students on campus, and particularly for students. If they use this resource in previous years when they were considering a school and finding best fit in their college and university, then they're more apt to participate in the survey and give us their opinion about what the experiences that they are academically or otherwise that they're having current day.
How much of this information does go into a student's decision making? I mean, you talk to a lot of students all over the country. How much is this, you know, top of mind for them?
You know what? When we first started to do this project 12 years ago, we knew that it was powerful, but we didn't quite realize how powerful it was. And that has really been the continuous push of putting out this information. Students have one, been using this in a significant way, but they are moving on from those universities into jobs of substance based on their sustainability practices as well. So that's the stuff that I really feel that students are voting with their feet and choosing a school that has a sustainability as a primary focus of education and campus life. But then it also prepares them for green jobs upon graduation. And those are the things that I honestly had underestimated 12 years ago, but it is just continuously underscored in each time we do this survey annually.
Well, you've got your regular annual survey. You've got your regular annual how to pay for schools. Now this green guide. Anything else up your sleeves?
Well, we're doing so many different things. You know, we keep focusing on this idea of college to career. We have a resource on our website called Best Value Colleges. I mean, college has not gotten any less expensive, even through our COVID times. And that is one of the things that causes so much fear and stress around students and their parents when thinking about college. So you can count on us continuously putting out information in that vein as well.
Rob Franek is the editor-in-chief of the Princeton Review. The Princeton Review's Guide to Green Colleges 2022 edition was released in October. An artist has combined her craft with science and came up with oysters. It'll all make sense in a minute. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
When art and science meet, good things can happen. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Carolyn Henney, professor in the Department of Art at Florida State University, discusses one such instance.
Sea Stars, my sculptural installation on a sandbar in Beaufort, North Carolina, is a colorful and biodegradable set of sculptures that will transform into living oyster reefs and be viewable during low tide. The work is driven by the belief in the power of exchange between disciplines and the ability for artists' works to serve as vehicles for inspiration, change, and action. This new direction in artistic research and production stems from my participation as the FSU representative at Bridging Chasms, a symposium involving 8 scholars from across the ACC. Each participant presented on elements and crucial details of their discipline. Dr. Niels Lindquist, a marine ecologist at UNC's Institute of Marine Sciences, was also a participant. He and his commercial fisherman partner David Cessna at the Sandbar Oyster Company have developed a uniquely successful substrate for attracting wild native oyster larvae. It had not occurred to Lindquist before we met that his materials research could also be employed to make sculpture. This fortunate encounter sparked our collaboration and affords me unique ways of making art capable of generating change and helping to heal the planet. I am using the opportunity to pivot to eco-conscious materials and proactively address environmental issues relative to food scarcity, climate change, water quality, and the reduction of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, all the while providing habitat to a wide range of marine life and helping to preserve shorelines.
That was Carolyn Henney of Florida State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.